Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 18th, 2016. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, homebrewer and beer historian Dave Jansen joins us to talk about grisettes, how they might have compared to saisons, and how he has been uncovering clues to this Belgian style of the past. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. And don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our BasicBrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first. Go to BasicBrewing.com, click on our Amazon ad on the right-hand side of the page. You can shop as you normally do. The only difference that you'll notice is that you'll get a warm feeling because you'll know you're supporting this podcast. We greatly appreciate your support if you do that, and lots of people do, and I'm grateful. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app at Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry Podcast Directory. We're on the Stitcher app, and we're on Google Play Music as well. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. I'm hearing from our friends down in New Zealand that the date has been set for the second annual New Zealand Homebrewers Conference. NZHC 2017 will be March 24th, 25th, and 26th in Nelson, New Zealand. And the keynote speakers this year will be mad fermentationist Mike Tonsmeyer and brewlosopher Marshall Schott. Very cool. I know that Mike and Marshall will have a blast down there. And they've got a lot of great information to share. So you can find more details about that at nzhc.nz. Sweet is, and wallem up. we had a blast down there, so I know that those guys will as well. I've been getting some great response from our most recent Basic Brewing video episode on sous vide cooking. Carl writes in, great video on sous vide. Thanks, Carl. I've been doing it in my e-kegel for some time. If you haven't tried carrots sous vide, you really should. 183 degrees for an hour with a little butter, pepper, and just a touch of sugar. Mm-mm. That does sound tasty. James writes, I recently watched your last video with Steve's sous vide steak and was inspired to try it myself. I have a grandfather and a food saver. I purchased a ribeye and seasoned with salt and pepper and vacuum sealed. I set the grandfather for 129 degrees and went 2 hours. I seared the steak on a hot charcoal grill and it was perfect. And FYI, my first beer on the grandfather was your cream ale, a very good beer. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that, James. My first beer on a grandfather was also the Green Ale. And thanks to Carl down in New Zealand, it turned out very well. Our buddy Scott Kuei sent me a link to a site where he found instructions for low-temperature pasteurizing to make pickles using the sous vide dealy. So that's another good use for the water bath technique. I'm looking forward to getting more into that using my high gravity system. And speaking of our friends, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa, we've got fun news coming from our sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. High Gravity is turning 12 years old, and Desiree and Dave are having a raffle and a celebration event to mark the occasion. The raffle is to give away a High Gravity brew-in-a-bag system or $1,000 in credit towards a Brew Easy or Build Your Own Brewery system that uses the High Gravity EBC controllers. You can find out all the details about the raffle on highgravitybrew.com. And the winner will be drawn on September 17th. Also on September 17th, Steve and I will be at High Gravity to have Basic Brewing stuff for sale and to sign, and we'll be at the event later that evening. So more details are coming soon on that event. So if you are in the Tulsa area or want to be in the Tulsa area, mark September 17th on your calendar and go to highgravitybrew.com for more details on the High Gravity 12th anniversary celebration. So congratulations to Desiree and Dave. Theirs is quite a success story. They were both in, in the corporate world and in IT, and decided to cut the cable, so to speak, and go out on their own and start their homebrew shop. And it just has gone very, very well. It's very happy to see them so successful. Let's get to my conversation with Dave Jansen, shall we? We met at HomebrewCon in Baltimore on club night. And after I got back, because his presentation was like 8 o'clock in the morning and the next morning, and I'm sorry, Dave, I like you and respect you, but that's way too early. But luckily, his presentation and all the presentations from HomebrewCon are on the AHA website, along with their slides too, the audio and the slides. So I went there and checked that out. And it's good. It's very good. You should look at it and listen to it if you haven't. We had a great chat for this episode. I just love hearing about obscure beer styles and efforts to bring them back to life and get them spread around again. Well, Dave Jansen, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, James. It's good to be back.
Yeah, I say have you back because we ran into you on the floor of Club Night and talked a little bit about grisettes and saisons, just a little tiny bit. But I wanted to have you back on so we could talk in more detail and we could talk about how to interpret this this old style, this obscure style, I guess you'd say, and bring it into the modern world and try to get something that resembles authenticity. So talk about your experience with these beers. How did you get on this subject and how did you do your research?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny story. So I've been interested in Saison for quite some time. As an early home brewer and having a couple of Belgian saisons and really opening my mind to that. And I went to Belgium back in 2009 and made a number of subsequent trips. So that got me really interested in saison, and that was my favorite type of beer. And then I started to see grisette popping up, and I knew about it from the small amount of information that you can find in books like Farmhouse Ales and Brewing with Wheat. And that's really all I'd seen about it, and that's pretty much all there is for the English brewing audience. And I started to see grisettes popping up in the commercial world, covering a wide range of different characteristics. There were sour beers. There were beers that almost seemed like session IPAs. There were beers with fruit or prominent spices. There were 100% Brett beers. And I was thinking to myself, none of these really seem to hit the core of what I think of as grisette. And what really pushed me into it was on the same day, two different breweries that were local to me released a beer that they were calling a grisette. And I saw these beers and I thought, that's not grisette-y, and this is the first time these beers have ever been in my local market, so other people around here don't know what grisette is, and this is going to define the style to them. And so I was thinking, am I wrong on what grisette is, or is it, was I right and it's not what these beers are? And so I started looking as much as I could to find this historic information. And for much of the last year, I was living in Europe for work, so that allowed me to go to Belgium as often as possible and make contacts with people there that were interested in beer history and go through historical archives of information. So I started digging through all I could find there through stuff like Le Petit Journal de Brasserie, which was based out of Brussels and has a lot of great information on historic beers and meeting people and tracking down anything about grisette I could find. And so that kind of helped me gather all the source material and come up with a more clear picture of what grisette might be.
And one of the sources that you used was commercial beer labels, which you showed in your presentation at HomebrewCon, and people can download the audio of your presentation and the PDF of your slides, which is really cool. So you were there's so little information out this that on this that you actually were looking at beer labels to get your information.
I was compiling all I could about beer labels, and I started to notice patterns. The labels would say certain things, like some of the Saison labels would be saying that it was an old beer, and labels of all different styles of beers would list these categories on them. And I later found out that these categories are related to tax structure based on the original gravity. So from that information, I could first figure out how frequently these beers showed up compared to other beers, based on how many Grisette labels I was seeing compared to Saison labels, compared to Pilsner labels. And then from that, I could also see what categories were listed on these different types of labels, which helped me to kind of form a general class of strength of the beers.
And what time period are we looking at here?
So most of my information is around 1900. And that's a really important point to raise, because we tend to think of historical beers as being one entity, but both through time and within one specific time among different producers, these beers are heterogeneous and changing. So so if you go back further in time, the beer is going to be different at 1800 than it was at 1900 than it is at the present day. So most of my information is probably 1875 to 1950, but I've seen mention of Grisette in some historical texts as early as 1812.
And so the part of the challenge of searching to, or finding this style or trying to nail down this style is that, number one, you don't have any existing or you don't have any surviving examples of the recipe from that time period, right?
Correct. Yeah, there's not one complete, well-explained recipe that I can look back on. There's more general brewing practices or very general descriptions of what the finished beer tasted like. And there's no Belgian modern Grisette that accurately reflects historic Grisette.
And also the ingredients themselves have changed over the years. I mean, you were talking about how kind of rustic the ingredients were back in the time period that you're researching. Talk about that.
Yeah, so changing ingredients is a pretty significant difference in historic and modern beer. And it makes it really difficult to try to clone a historic beer because the ingredients that you have access to today are fundamentally different. So much of Belgium on the whole, well beyond the scope of only Grisette, was using winter six-row barley as the prominent barley for beer. There was also spring six-row barley. So comparing to what we're using in North America, we're almost always using two-row. So the six-row barley is a difference, which would mean higher protein levels in the grain. And the winter six-row as well probably had slightly higher protein levels due to drought stresses and other factors in the different growing seasons. So a winter grain, a winter six-row would be quite different than the normal spring two-row that we'd have access to in North America. And then other grains that might be around, like wheat or oats, might or might not have been malted, and the malting would have been done at different levels. So another important factor about these grains is that up until about 1950, it's not common to find a brewing-specific grain and a feed-specific grain. So you just have multi-purpose grains that are going to different pools depending on the need of the local farmer. And that means that the grains might not be perfectly suited for malting. So the malting is dealing with unevenly germinating grains, uneven modification in the grains. And then the kilns would have been unevenly distributing temperature, quite likely. So certain regions, you have hot spots and cold spots in the kiln, which is going to result in a malt of many different colors, not one distinct or one very tight color range. So because the malt itself is not perfectly suited for brewing, and because the kiln might be somewhat rudimentary, you don't have a uniform, perfect malt. Generally, these grains tend to be under-modified by modern standards, and especially, as we'll get into probably with Grisette, the wheat would be extremely under-modified. So when you're looking at the commercial modern malts that you can get access to, they're quite different in terms of modification and color. And the base properties of the grain that would make them good for brewing.
So step one in brewing an authentic grisette, get some crappy ingredients.
Yeah, I guess so. If you want to brew historic styles accurately, the ingredients are, we have much more high quality ingredients generally today. I mean, there certainly were high quality ingredients before, and some of the Landrace hop varieties, you know, they're around today because they're always good hops. But those also would have been more expensive hops, and a small brewer in Belgium wasn't necessarily bringing in a whole lot of German and Czech and English hops. They're probably using, for the most part, hops grown around them and saving the best hops for the special beers. So you have these low alpha hops that might not be optimum, and then you're using high levels of those hops, which might result in a harsher bitterness because you have more plant material and more beta acid per unit alpha acid. So yeah, definitely differences in ingredients. And to some extent, yeah, the historic ingredients would have been pretty poor by modern standards.
Now they, of course, I'm being sarcastic, but
exactly.
But they were able to take. I'm assuming that they had to compensate through the brewing process to compensate for the lower quality ingredients that they had back then. Like, for instance, you probably weren't doing like a single temperature infusion mash with grains that are unevenly malted and such as that.
Yeah, exactly. So both for properly dealing with the grain and for properly dealing with the legal structure of Belgium in the 1800s, mashing was a pretty involved process. So brewers tended to overload their mash tuns with a quite high grain to liquid ratio. And then in order to process that, they do an infusion. They might drain off that infusion in kind of like a turbid mashing type approach or a decoction type approach. Reinfuse, heat it up to the next step, and they'd go through a number of different steps. Even in some modern brews, something like a 5-step mash is not unheard of for some modern saison breweries. So starting quite low and quite low in temperature, so cool mashes to start, something in the 100 to 115 Fahrenheit range, or about 40 to 45 Celsius, and starting with an incredibly thick mash. It almost looks like a dough or something like that. It's like wet grain instead of grain sitting in water. And then from that point raising up because of the nature to brew with this ridiculous grain to water ratio. And then also to hit so many steps in the mash tun without it overflowing.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the presentation that their mash tuns probably weren't heated. So if you're going to do a step mash, you're going to start with something that's really, really thick because you don't want to dilute it too much along the way as you're adding, boiling water or hot water to bring the mash temperatures up during those rests.
Yeah, that's correct. So if you go to some of the breweries using older equipment around Belgium, it's not uncommon to see open iron mash tuns, maybe lined with wood on the outside to help insulate a bit, and maybe with a cover on top, although that's a little bit less common. But places like Cantillon have one of these mash tuns. Some of the other lambic producers. If you go to Brasserie à Vapour in the Saison region of Belgium, that has one of these. DuPont used to use a mash tun like this as well. So kind of like tuna can shaped mash tuns made out of iron and open topped is not uncommon. So definitely not something you can heat.
What kind of gravity ranges are we looking at?
For the average beer around 1900, we're probably looking at something in the range of 1030 to 1040. So that influences what a strong beer would be. To us, that average gravity range is, to us in the modern world, that's a low gravity beer. But if the average gravity range is in the 1030s to 1040s range, then a strong beer could be 1050s. And that's sort of what I expect with grisette, that a normal grisette would have been in the mid 1030s, perhaps 1040s. A stronger grisette, maybe mid 1040s up to 1050 or so, and then saisons generally in the 1050s around 1900. I think is roughly the sort of gravity range we're talking about for these beers and the context of those beers to average Belgian beer. It wouldn't have been uncommon to find a beer, though, that's in the 1020s. Either it could possibly have been the case for grisettes and some saisons at the time, but in general, there's much more common to find like low strength table beers or house beers that were quite low in gravity, perhaps made by a second runnings type approach.
So if we're going to duplicate or try to mimic an authentic grisette today,
yeah,
what's the malt bill going to look like for us?
Okay, so what I've seen from the historical records from grisette malt bills is something on the order of 85% malted barley and 15% malted wheat. And the texts are quite clear and quite emphatic that wheat should be malted. But the malting of the wheat is quite different from what you'd find in a normal malted wheat. So to get into the nature of these malts, the barley, I've seen some places describe the barley as a winter six-row barley, this barley I mentioned before that was common throughout all of Belgium. I've seen other sources recommend a spring six-row barley. Generally, at the time, the winter six-row barley was thought to be very good for beers that were aging, but that perhaps it produced a rougher beer if you wanted the beer to be consumed young. And one of the fundamental characteristics about average grisette, about the normal grisette, is that it was a beer to be consumed young, which is a contrast to Saison of the same time made at the same breweries, that Saison is a beer built for aging and grisette is not. So perhaps the spring six-row barley is a better choice for that reason. It would have been modified fairly well, but under-modified compared to modern standards. The wheat would have been malted, again, to help design the beer for consumption younger. An unmalted wheat would have been beneficial for aging beers, for example, like lambics that have a high proportion of unmalted wheat. But the malted wheat would have helped produce a beer that's young and stable sooner, or it would have produced a stable beer sooner, so it would have been better for a younger beer. And there's certainly examples of unmalted wheat in young beer, but those beers might develop more acidity or something like that, whereas grisette, I would say, is not, by its design, an acidic beer. So the wheat would have been, the modern term for this would have been chitted malt or chit malt. So it would have been a chitted wheat, which means that as the grain starts to sprout, just when it starts to sprout, that tiny sprout is called a chit in malting terms. And that little nub where the sprout comes, once that shows up, then the malt is kilned. It's dried and kilned, and killing the malt and stopping the conversion. So a very under-modified malt. Chitted or chit malt for barley is a little bit more available, so you can see that on the marketplace from select producers. And the way that, if you don't have access to a chit malt in the barley world, the way that people recommend getting around that is blending flaked barley and normal barley malt to get a mixture of something that's not very modified with the highly modified normal barley malt. So analogously, in the world of wheat, we can probably do the same. So if you don't have access to a chitted wheat, then you could perhaps blend some flaked wheat with normal wheat malt to reach a total wheat percentage on the order of 15%. I think going higher than that is probably okay, but the records I've seen say about 15%.
So under-modified means that it's not going to have as many enzymes, right? Or it's not going to be strong as in diastatic power as a more fully modified malt?
Yeah, and that the malt itself wouldn't be broken down as much before the mashing, so that perhaps in the mashing, the brewer has to do a little bit more work to get everything out. So there's less protein degradation in the malt. There's less of this enzyme development, as you mentioned, and the starches haven't been broken down into sugars as much, so that during mashing, the mashing process to get the same resulting wort stream out has to be a little bit more intensive.
So here's a philosophical question.
Yeah.
You have these brewers back then using these, fairly primitive, as far as our standards are concerned, primitive ingredients and primitive techniques to reach a certain quality of wort.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any advantage to our following their example and dumbing down our going back in time and getting lower quality ingredients or trying to mimic lower quality ingredients and then going to all the struggles that they had to do to get their ingredients to measure up to what we can theoretically do with a lot less work? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I to me, my personal interest is not in cloning historic beers. I'm really interested in historic beer research, and Grisette's one of the beers I've looked into. I've looked into the ways that other beers have changed or beers that don't exist anymore as well. So I'm interested in looking at these historic beers for inspiration of how to use some of those techniques, or perhaps how to make beers with the same end goal, but not necessarily always cloning historical process or trying to source these ingredients that might be very difficult to work with, as you mentioned. So I think they would result in a different beer. Whether or not it's a better beer is a bit of a different story, perhaps. But for example, using a malt with a higher protein content would result in, presuming that you go through the proper mashing to break that protein down, would result in a darker wort in the end because of more melanoidin reaction. So from the same malt color, you would get a darker wort, and from the same kilning process, you would get a darker malt to begin with based on the conditions of that malt. A six row with maybe more of a husk material could yield a little bit of astringency, which to a low level I find pleasant in saisons. Obviously, I don't want to be sucking on a tea bag, but to a low level, I like a little bit of astringency in beers like saisons and grisettes. So there are some characteristics that these brewers were getting, whether or not they intended to, based on their ingredients, that I think can be beneficial to certain tastes in the modern world. But then there's also the issue of changing taste preferences because of what modern beer is. And of course, the historic brewers had to deal with this too. Imported beers were coming in, and it changed the taste preferences of the consumers. And because of that, maybe the brewers changed what beers they were making, or changed the nature of those beers to kind of push them in directions like towards Pilsners, or maybe Belgian brewers start to brew stouts because stouts are popular and they're coming over from England. I'm not one necessarily to advocate cloning historic beer and going through lots of work to do so. I do like intensive mashing. I think it makes the wort taste different. So if you do a turbid mash and you compare that to a multi-step infusion mash or a couple steps of infusion mashing, it does taste different. The wort tastes different. And I kind of like the characteristic of a turbid mash, but I don't think it's necessary to go through tons of trouble to exactly reproduce a historic beer when perhaps that isn't even possible, even if you tried to source the right sort of ingredients.
So there's no shame in doing a modern, single infusion brew in a bag grisette.
No, I think you could make a beer that fit grisette characteristics perfectly fine with a single infusion. Yeah, the modern Belgian brewers today tend to still do multiple steps, but maybe they're doing three steps instead of four or five or six, or maybe two or three steps. So I usually brew with a 2 to 3 step mash. I think you can make great beer with a single infusion.
It'd be interesting to do a side by side and see what the differences are.
Yeah, we should get Marshall on that.
Yeah, quick philosopher plug in there.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll see. I think there's a lot of small factors that maybe taken on their own don't add up to a large difference. But if you go through a bunch of these different small factors, it probably yields more easily discernible results. So to simply change the mashing probably isn't a big deal, especially if you are using the modern ingredients, as you mentioned, that don't require that. Maybe it's even better to do that because you don't want to break down your highly modified malt too much. So
yeah, that's
perhaps
a good
it's
point.
Better not to go through an extreme mashing process, yeah.
And maybe you could add a few specialty grains in there just to mimic, some of the characteristics that you're shooting for.
Yeah, so if you were, for example, like in a saison, if you wanted to match some of the more amber-like color that probably would have been common in a lot of historic saisons, you could maybe use something like a Vienna malt or a continental pale malt. Dingemans makes a pale malt that Cantillon uses for their beer Iris. And that comes out, I think it's interesting to consider that beer as being quite similar to some historic saisons. And I think that's a fairly accurate comparison. So, for example, using something like a continental pale malt could help you get a bit of a darker wort than a Pilsner malt would yield.
So the, I guess should we be comparing and contrasting grisettes with saisons along the way? And if you were to change gears from a grisette to a saison, you know, with the grain bill and with the mash, how would they differ?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about this. I think the modern brewer in North America tends to think of grisette as a low strength saison. And while I don't think that's entirely inaccurate, I think that's not the best way to look at it. And I think that leads to a lot of beers being made that don't accurately reflect what grisette is. So I think comparing it is a really good way to think about this. So historically, at around 1900 and before, I would say that the main difference between the two beers is that saison is a beer inherently built for aging well, and grisette is not. A lot of the considerations into producing a grisette are to produce a beer that is ready to be consumed younger. And there are grisettes historically that would have been aged a bit more, but those are brewed with the same process as the younger beers. So while saison is a beer built for aging historically, grisette, I think, is not, based on the records that I've seen. Grisette is always described as being a wheat beer, so it's a beer requiring wheat, and saison is not, and potentially some saisons might be better without wheat. So some of the Brussels brewers, this Petit Journal de Brasserie that I mentioned before, when they're recommending how they get, there's a lot of question and answer in that journal. So people will write in and say, I want to brew a saison. Here's what I was thinking of doing. What do you guys think about that? And then there's a response that says what in the plan was good and bad. And generally, for aging beers, the Petit Journal de Brasserie recommends 100% six-row winter barley, perhaps some unmalted wheat, or other unmalted grains, but generally 100% six-row. So that would be different than grisette. The malting of grisette, which I didn't get too much into, was the kilning temperatures were very low for that malt. It was sort of like a wind-dried malt more than a properly kilned malt. So the grain itself would have been extremely pale, especially for the time. Saison, I think that's not necessarily the case. So maybe the saison would come out more amber. I think grisettes could have been a bit darker than a golden, but I think also with the malting described in this Pelset text that we've mentioned so far, there's one book that exists about grisette, and it's from 1874, and otherwise it's scattered records here and there. So this one book describes the malting and the temperatures for kilning are very low. So if that book is accurate and representative of all of grisette, then grisette would have been quite likely rather pale, and saison might not have been. Based on the gravities, I think that it is accurate to say for the most part grisette is weaker than saison, but I don't think that's the defining characteristic. I think that's an aspect of making a beer that's good for aging versus not. If you wanted to design a beer for age, you would probably make it a slightly higher gravity. You wouldn't want to brew a very weak beer to age for a long time, whereas grisette was intended to be ready younger, so it probably would have been brewed to a lower gravity, and that's what the records that I'm seeing are supporting. And the final thing I'll add to the general comparison so far, again, with this age versus not age, is to do with hopping. So saison seems like it was hopped at a higher rate than grisette, so would have resulted in a more bitter beer and also a beer that could last aging better. Grisette, it seems, was still hopped at a reasonable rate such that it wouldn't become acidic, or if it did, it would be over a fairly long time, generally longer than a lot of the grisettes would have been sticking around, and it wouldn't have become dominantly acidic. So it would have been a beer brewed with mixed culture, both saison and grisette, brewed with non-pure yeast cultures, so Saccharomyces yeast, probably Brettanomyces yeast, probably lactic acid bacteria in both of these beers. But because grisette's not designed for aging, that wouldn't show up, and it would be smoother because of the lower hopping rates. So so something like maybe 4 grams per liter hopping, which in silly units would be about half an ounce per gallon. And saison could have been up maybe around 7 or 8 grams per liter at the same time. So 1.5 to twice as much hopping in saisons probably.
So it's a cleaner beer, I guess you'd say, than a saison. Mm-hmm. With our modern ingredients, if you're not trying to get kind of a funky flavor out of your grisette, could you brew it at home with a more neutral yeast?
Yeah, so yeast is, I think, one of the trickiest remaining parts because in the historic records of these beers, there's not a lot of discussion about what specifically the yeast would have been like in terms of flavor profiles. So I think it would be accurate to brew a grisette with a saison yeast. I think it would also be accurate to brew a grisette with a more neutral yeast. And that's a bit of a remaining question that I'm not. That I wish I had a better answer for, but I've seen both represented. So there's Farmhouse Ales has a quick blurb from a brewer that an old retired brewer who would have been alive when grisette was still made while he was also making saisons. So he would have had a pretty good idea about the characteristics between the two beers, and he described grisette as being generally saison-like. I've seen other texts that liken grisette to pilsner, and what I'm absolutely certain is that those texts are not saying grisette was a lager like pilsner. What they might be saying is that grisette's flavor profile on the whole was somewhat comparable to a pilsner flavor profile. And that could be because they're both relatively clear blonde beers with a noticeable hopping rate. It could mean that the grisette yeast was more neutral. So perhaps thinking of grisette as like a working class Pilsner-like beer made in Belgium with ale fermentation is not an inaccurate way to go about it. It might be, I'm not sure what's more accurate, whether to use a Saison yeast or to use something like a Trappist yeast at a low temperature or a different Belgian ale yeast at a lower temperature. But I think if you compare, for example, something like an Abbey or a Trappist single, so Westmalle makes a beer they call Extra. The West Vleteren Blonde is another beer like this, although it's a bit stronger. These beers are sort of like a Pilsner wort that's then fermented with the same yeast that brewery uses to make all their beers. And those, I think, are probably in the ballpark of what historic grisette would have been like, perhaps a bit stronger. So I think, yeah, thinking about grisette as having a more neutral yeast is an accurate way to do it. I think using a saison yeast is also accurate, and the Belgian brewers that know history that are making modern grisettes here and there are using their house saison yeast. But I think that if you wanted to use a slightly more neutral yeast, I don't think that would classify your beer as definitely not a grisette.
And of course, we're spending all this time talking about a Belgian quote unquote style, and somewhere Peter Brucard is wringing his hands and he doesn't know why, but
Yeah, I want to anger all the Belgians.
so it is. I mean, it is up to interpretation. And I guess that, if the style covers such a wide range, or you're throwing such a wide net, at some point you could have a philosophical discussion on why, talking about styles are useful or not useful. So I guess in a way it's up to your interpretation. Like for instance, if you're a home brewer and you want to brew a grisette that has some saison-y characteristics, and is essentially just a session saison. Well, that's I would say that's fine. That's up to you.
I think that's a good way to think about it, and to bring up the context of how silly it is to talk about beer style so firmly. And I feel a bit funny about this myself. So I have a blog where I talk about these historic beer things and other brewing stuff that I'm doing. And the name of that blog is, if I say it, not the way a French person would say it, but the way an English person would say it, it's Hors Category, category spelled with an IE, and that means like beyond categorization or out of category.
So spell the whole thing. What's your URL?
Yeah, it's horscategorybrewing.com. So HorsCategorie, and then brewing, BrewiNG, .com. So that's where you can find all my work on these sorts of beers, as well as other historic beers I'm looking into and some modern brewing stuff that I've been doing. But the whole blog started by being interested in brewing beers that didn't fit discrete styles because the name is out of categorization or out of category. And then I've kind of one of the ways the blog's become the audience has grown the most outside of people I know is this Crozet research, which is basically trying to say, what is this style of beer like, which is somewhat an oxymoron with my name. So I feel a bit funny about that. But you're absolutely right that that Grisette is not a discrete entity, and neither is Saison. And these beers, as I mentioned, both over time and within one time, based on what the different brewers are doing, would have been not one unit. And so that's why I try to think about these beers from an intention point of view and from a general characteristic. So I've been stressing that Grisette is not a beer designed for aging, and Saison is a beer designed for aging, because that you can design a beer for aging or not aging with multiple different approaches, but they show a certain intent. And so the brewers brewing Grisette would have been doing different things that would have been different to how they would approach a Saison to meet the intent of a Grisette. And otherwise, specific parameters, I think, are a little bit looser. So that's a good point.
Yeah, and if you are producing a commercial beer and you want to, I mean, the one thing that's handy about styles is that you can slap a style description on a bottle of beer or a can of beer, and, you know, your customers will have a certain expectation of what's in that before they buy it, because you can't just have a sampler. You can't just taste every beer before before you buy it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess, for instance, if you had a brewery and you brewed both Grisette and Saison, that would be an interesting way to, you know, to differentiate those two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I was frustrated about seeing so many commercial Grisettes, is because it was giving a meaning to this style or not style or whatever, however you want to think about Belgian classes of beers. It was giving a meaning to Grisette that I thought wasn't an accurate meaning. And so it made me try to find the truth to see if I was wrong or if those beers really didn't reflect the meaning of Grisette. I think there should be some sort of integrity with naming, but I don't want to spend my time being a beer style police person going around saying, that's not Grisette, that's not Grisette, that's not Grisette. You know, if I have a beer that's quite sour, I'm fairly confident in saying that doesn't reflect Grisette. Or right. If I have a beer with no wheat or no other wheat-like grains, I'm fairly confident saying, that doesn't match with historic Grisette.
So what's the hop character and how do you achieve it?
Yeah, the hop character would have been noticeably bitter. And based on the way I've seen these beers described, it probably isn't a huge dose of late hops in the boil. So I've recently brewed, and I'm drinking now, although it's a little bit young in the bottle. I've brewed a beer that I would say fits Grisette more than any previous ones I've done based on some of this historic information. And I used about 4 grams per liter to hop that, shooting for something on the order of 20 IBUs out of the bittering edition, and something like, another 10 or 15 IBUs out of the finishing edition. So I did brew it heavier on late hops than it traditionally would have been brewed, but on the order of 4 grams per liter total, and not a huge dose of late hops. The brewers would have been using mostly Belgian hops probably, and the exact hopping rates depend on where those hops come from. So there's a quite a difference in hop quality if they're hops from the good hop-growing regions of Belgium or the average anywhere else in Belgium, or if they're hops coming from England or Bavaria or Bohemia, the non-Belgian hops tend to be higher quality. So a beer of a noticeable bitterness, a bitterness to gravity ratio approaching 1, which is, for a lower-strength beer, can be fairly bitter. Maybe not by North American IPA-type standards. Noble type hop character, or at least continental European type character, and then also English type character. So not a lot of fruity hops in a traditional Grisette, although I think you could make a good Grisette type beer using fruity or New World hops. And maybe a little bit of the astringency that I mentioned before, although less than a Saison would have. And then a light dry hopping would also have been appropriate, probably not required, but a dry hopping on the order of 1 gram per liter. So I'm listing all these things off in grams per liter. But 1 gram per liter is about 0.1 ounces per gallon. 4 grams per liter is about 0.5 ounce per gallon. So a a boil addition of about 1/2 ounce per gallon, and then a possibly a dry hop at about 0.1-ish ounces per gallon. So a really low dry hop, but maybe to bring up some of those aromatics right before serving. And yeah, not a beer bursting with finishing hop flavor, but with something noticeable. And I think thinking about the hops, this is where it's good to think about grisette relating to a Pilsner type beer, because the fermentation character obviously is not the same. If one's an ale of mixed culture and one's a pure culture lager, then they're certainly not the same fermentation wise. But the hops, I think, is probably where some of that comparison is drawn, that it's hoppy the way that a good Pilsner would have been hoppy, and crisp in that way.
So how do you differentiate a grisette, say, from a modest gravity pale ale?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So it sort of is like a modest gravity Belgian pale ale to a degree. And then what would differentiate that from, say, an English pale ale or a North American pale ale would be the malts used and the yeast used and the hops used. But otherwise, the formulation could be comparable. So I think, I think grisette probably wouldn't have been as dark as many pale ales. I don't think there would have been a lot of caramelized malt in it, perhaps a little bit based on poor drying of the grain, but probably not a lot. And the kiln temperatures would have been, I think, too low to really develop much of that. Whereas perhaps an English pale or a North American pale would have a little bit more more of a caramel type character. The inclusion of wheat, especially wheat that's been mostly wind dried rather than a real kilning, would also help to keep the color fairly pale. And then if grisette is using hops like noble hops or maybe East Kent Goldings, then it's certainly historically not going to be as fruity as a lot of other pale ales. In that regard, more of an herbal, spicy type character. And then I think a fairly low finishing gravity, although not as low as you'd get with a Saison because you don't have time for that mixed culture to develop. So I think, I think that grisette is sort of like a historic Belgian pale ale to a degree.
What are your favorite yeast strains to use in a grisette and a Saison?
Yeah, I'm partial to yeast blending. I think that I haven't found one commercial strain that gives me the fermentation behavior and flavor profile that I'm looking for. So I tend to blend Saison strain of DuPont origin, so something like Y-Yeast 3724 or White Labs, I think it's 565. I tend to blend something like that with a yeast of French origin, or according to Y-Yeast, French origin. So something like 3711. I think that the blend of those two gives me the dryness I want in the sort of time frame I want, but I blend them favoring the Belgian DuPont origin yeast, so it's maybe like an 80% 3724 Belgian Saison and a 20% 3711 French Saison. That's what I'm partial to for many of my beers, and I've made grisettes like that I quite like. If I were going to use a single strain, the best single strain I've ever come across is what Brasserie Thierrier is using in northwest France. So they're theoretically the origin of 3711, but 3711 certainly behaves differently in terms of fermentation character, of behavior of fermentation, and also is different in terms of flavor profile. And I think the French Saison, the actual Thierrier yeast compared to the French Saison, the Thierrier yeast gives a flavor profile that I like more, still ferments reliably, and I think it works beautifully with pale hoppy beers especially. I think that's where it really shines. So that would be my favorite single strain to use if I was going to choose only one Saison yeast.
Now, historically, you said that these beers were probably cooled using a cool ship, that was open to the air, and then perhaps open fermentation as well.
Yep.
There's it's certainly not a single strain fermentation, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, correct. Historically, it's definitely not single strain. There's a really cool discussion. So some of the old British brewing journals, generally they didn't spend a lot of time talking about Belgian beers, but they show up here and there. And at the end of these articles from the early 1900s, there's usually a transcript following the article. So somebody would write this article about some topic. And at the end, these great brewing minds of the time in the area would sit around and discuss it. And that discussion would be transcribed in the article. So there's this great discussion where one of the people listening to George Johnson paper about Belgian mashing and Belgian beers. So at the end that this is in 1918 that he's saying this, that, well, we know that in top fermentation breweries, there's no such thing as a pure culture. So obviously these beers are multiple yeast strains blended together or yeast and bacteria blended together, even before you consider, like, that's just the yeast that's being added in. But then also, yeah, this open fermentation and open cooling does allow the option of more stuff coming into the beer. So to look at a modern day analog of this, something like what Jester King does, where they're using a mixed culture, but some of their beers come out fairly young. And if you have something like Petit Prince when it's young, it's probably not actually all that different from what Grisette would be. Maybe it's a little bit hoppier, and maybe some other minor differences. But then as that beer ages, the mixed culture starts to express itself. So you can have a mixed culture beer young if you have the appropriate mixed culture, and it still tastes great and kind of tastes like a clean Saison with maybe a little bit of extra stuff. But then as you age that beer out, it changes. So yeah, if you were going to try to approach this in a historically accurate manner, you'd want a good mixed culture. Maybe something that's heavier on the Saccharomyces because you're going to be going through it quickly to make a Grisette. But with these other microbes in there, that if you aged it and were making something with like a Saison with the same culture, then you'd get that that vinous character, some acidity, some Brettanomyces expression.
Well, it sounds like a big wide playing field to play around in and experiment and come up with our own variations, and then discuss politely over a pint of each as to which one is more authentic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm, and when it comes down to it, my goal is not to make historically authentic beer. My goal is to make good beer. And perhaps if I'm trying to present something as a historic entity, then to be authentic. But generally, I want to make a good beer rather than an authentic beer.
Awesome. That is a worthy goal, Dave.
Yeah, that's what we're all trying to do.
Are there any final tips that we haven't talked about specifically that you found to kind of bring some authenticity to these?
No, yeah, I think we've covered a lot of the ground points, and I kind of like how this discussion's gone. I don't want to present necessarily clone recipes because first off, I'd just be fabricating those out of all the things that I've learned rather than literally transcribing a recipe. But also, I think it's more important to consider the intention of the beer and the general process that brewers would have been using and move from that. So I think we've covered that quite well. I think that if there's a little bit of stuff that we didn't cover, then I'm not too worried about that. But one thing that I will add is that historically it was not uncommon in Belgium to maybe blend different beers together and to take an acid beer and to blend that into a younger beer to maybe simulate an aged beer, but in a cheaper, easier way as some brewers might have been trying to do, or maybe just because that's the intention you want in that beer. So I think that taking some of these old ideas and making new beers, a cool way to go about that maybe is to make a cleaner fermentation young beer and take a bit of an old beer and blend that in maybe a 10 or 20% ratio. And let that develop in the bottle so you can have it younger with a bit of this old character, or you could sit on it for a while and it could really develop more of that aged beer quality. And so that's something that that I think some Saison brewers were doing and other brewers in Belgium making beers similar to Saisons, even if they didn't call them such, both in the historic and the modern world. And that's something I think is maybe one of the coolest takeaways from some of this historic information into the modern world, that we can use these different techniques of designing a beer for aging, making that aged beer, maybe blending some of that in with some beer that we haven't designed for aging, and getting something in the middle.
Awesome. It sounds like a topic for another show.
Yeah, I think so. There's always more to talk about.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it, Dave. This has been a lot of fun. And if you haven't heard, again, if you haven't heard Dave's presentation, go to the AHA site. It's for members only, so you have to join. It's a good reason to join, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And check out the audio presentation and the slides. And it's a lot of good stuff. Appreciate it, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for having me, James. This is a great conversation.
Well, thanks again to Dave. Be sure to check out his blog, horscategorybrewing.com, horscategoriebrewing.com. I really admire his curiosity and tenacity in digging for information about these beers, and I will add Grisette to my long list of things to try when I'm around the brew kettle. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all of that stuff out at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that are purchased through the link are Calmer, Easier, Happier Parenting, 5 Strategies That End the Daily Battles and Get Kids to Listen the First Time. And to pair along with that, Cocktail Shaker Set, Best Professional Bar Kit Bundle with Double Stainless Steel Jigger and Recipes Booklet. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. Well, that's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.